This is an enormous pleasure for me to welcome you, alumni, students, faculty, and staff, to what we think, if our numbers are correct, is the largest gathering of Cornell architects, artists, and planners in our history, which I think means in history. Back in 2009, when I promised the graduating class that we'd have a little gathering when Milstein Hall was complete, I really had no idea what I was getting into. The numbers grew a little bit. You can look forward to what looks like will be a 36-hour, 800-person, double-dome party, the likes of which this college has never witnessed. Welcome, again. The large number of individuals who gave their time, energy, and creativity to help this college during what was a critical, and I would say even existential, phase over the last decade is very, very large. I will take the opportunity today and again tomorrow to thank a number of them on behalf of the college and to many of you who made this moment possible. But first and foremost, I want to recognize the Milstein family for sticking with us for what was almost a decade and recognize them tonight. Thank you. I also want to extend my heartfelt thanks to many, many of you in this room who are donors to this project and vocal supporters of this project. Thank you very much for your support. I want to recognize also the important contributions of my predecessors who pushed hard and pushed persistently, although I have to say they didn't always push in the same direction, to make this project possible. And let me name them. Porus Upadwala, who could not be here tonight because his plane ran into difficulties. Anthony Vidler, Stan Taft, and of course, Moisen Mostafafi, to whom we have the debt of gratitude for bringing Rem Koolhaas and OMA to this project. They all pulled a huge amount of weight, and I thank them. I also want to thank the AAP staff who worked tirelessly to organize this weekend. Let me tell you that we don't do parties regularly here. We do many other things, but nothing like this. Events manager Beth Kunz, among many others, worked tirelessly to put this together, and I'd like a round of applause for Beth. I will do my best to moderate the events this weekend, and I have parenthetical remarks to Kent. Moderate the events, but not your behavior. And I will try to address logistical questions along the way. Let me give you one useful tip, maybe the one that you need to remember. If you have a question, ask somebody with a red badge. Red denotes staff, and as you might recall from your student days, if you want an answer rather than a critical reframing of your question, you should ask a staff person. Red is staff. You should have a program guide. You should have a lanyard color-coded to your academic department. The events are registered for those. The events are reserved for those who have registered. So when you walk around in and out of the building, please wear your badge so you can get in and out. Before I came to Cornell 3.5 years ago, I thought that the long and publicly circuitous path to a design for this building was the result of internal differences. I was wrong, it was not. At stake with Milstein Hall were matters that were deeper and I think more fundamental to the future of the departments, the college, and actually to the university itself. The underlying questions went like this. What was the proper place for a cluster of disciplines that are neither science nor humanities, but rather a third hybrid mode of critical inquiry? Was the art and science of placemaking really a full-fledged member of Cornell's intellectual firmament? did Cornell truly embrace our forms of research and discovery? And could the departments themselves speak with common cause in addressing the pressing issues facing global communities? This building has often been described as an imperative necessitated by accreditation. This is not untrue. But this project could only be completed when we had answered the above questions. And standing here today, there can be no doubt about our position. The disciplines in AAP are indeed at the forefront of urgent questions facing societies globally. The intellectual and creative collaborations across disciplinary boundaries, both within the college and beyond, are vibrant and vital to this university. And AAP's knowledge domains are broadly embraced now as a framework for an impressive range of scholarship and research across the campus and across the globe. The core challenges associated with this building were therefore never merely formal, and the resulting project is both a remarkable accomplishment architecturally and a transformative pedagogical tool. It is by design that Milstein Hall functions as connective tissue, uniting students and faculty across departments. The lively dialogue with the present and the past that you experience in this building is both a quality of the architecture itself and a quality of our academic mission. And it is not happenstance that Milstein Hall announces itself as a bold public face for this university, for this is how we understand our role, urbanistically and academically. Given the complex nature of the task to design not just a building, but really an educational construct, it seems, in retrospect, almost predestined that eventually we would intersect with this generation's most intellectually precise and conceptually imaginative architectural mind. No contemporary architect, in my opinion, other than Rem Koolhaas, could have clarified with us and for us and embodied in space and material our complex needs and our aspirational spirit. You will have a chance and have had a chance to see this extraordinary instrument called Milstein Hall at work today and tomorrow. And you can form and will form your own judgments. I can tell you that the transformation of the college is already profound. And I want to thank Rem, thank OMA, thank partner Shoei Shigematsu, thank project architect Ziad Shihab, and thank the entire OMA New York office for this inspired and inspiring building. It is a great honor to have Rem with us this afternoon. He has lectured 3 times at Cornell during the course of this project. Each was a public tour de force. Today, instead of a keynote lecture, Rem has agreed to a more intimate, and I suppose I should put that in quotes, a more intimate presentation, followed by a discussion and a chance for you to ask questions of him. We only have 1 hour together with them, so I will not use more of his time or your time with a long introduction. Suffice it to say that this college, this university, and I am deeply indebted to Rem, and it is and will always be an honor to have you in our midst. Please help me welcome Rem Koolhaas.
I was asked to do a short autobiography, and I decided to respond, and therefore I pretend tonight to be a completely sincere open book and try to assemble a kind of brief series of episodes that kind of ultimately shape our architecture. And so I will basically take the highlights. I was born in this city at this moment. You can only say that that is kind of probably a disaster. On the other hand, it's probably also an ideal moment for an architect. And it is probably also no coincidence that I'm still working in the city, and that this city has become known for its new architecture. When I was 8, my parents took me to Indonesia, which had recently become an independent country. And for that reason, my father was a journalist who had taken the Indonesian side against the Dutch, who didn't want to give up Indonesia. And that meant that I had to live for 4 years as an Asian, go to Indonesian schools, Indonesian Boy Scouts, speak Indonesian, and therefore experience both the experience of Islam as a kind of practice, and also experience a very vigorous and emerging country in Asia. My father was, because he had chosen the Indonesian side, quite friendly with the leader of Indonesia at the time, Sukarno. And in the years I was there, Mao was a visitor and Richard Nixon. Perhaps also because of this training or this early experience, I did not know what to do when I was 18. And because I didn't know what to do, I became a journalist. And because journalism is a kind of wonderful profession for those who have not made up their mind, because it is kind of really a series of very short engagements with different subjects. And one of my engagements was with movies and with film, and here I'm at 19 interviewing Federico Fellini. In 68, I was a journalist in Paris when the revolution broke out. And basically that event had a kind of galvanizing effect on me. And I decided at that time, when I was 24, to become an architect. So there, suddenly I was, you know, from a kind of relatively affluent young person, I became a student again. Quite troubling experience, particularly because it was in London at the time of flower power. For a European, it was extremely, of my interest, it was extremely hard to absorb and to understand the kind of architecture that was being taught there. This is a kind of diagram of Peter Eisenman's archigram. And you can see it is about typical 60 things like glamour, beauty, and fun. So with my continental training, I felt a complete misfit and tried to orient myself and had to orient myself on other kinds of architecture and other experiences. And I became quickly convinced and inspired by Moscow and what Moscow meant in modern architecture, and particularly by one architect, Ivan Leonidov, who was born on the Russian countryside, who came to Moscow when he was 16, who went to an art school, the Vutemas, and who at 24 was a fully fledged genius, defining the new life. He was in such an incredible hurry that he would do competitions on blackboards with chalk. And so this was a drawing that he did on a blackboard in 8 hours during a single evening. And for me, architecture produced at that speed and also of that explicitness in terms of how to organize life. Became very, very exciting. So in other words, I was not so much interested by the shapes, and as you can see, the shapes are essentially dull, but I was interested by the dimension and ambition to organize life differently. This was another drawing also in charcoal. In a way to launch my own private polemic with Archigram, I decided to study something kind of really sinister, as architecture, and I took the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was then 7 years old, and we had in our school curriculum had to document a kind of single existing building, and so I went for the Berlin Wall and kind of simply reconstructed its history, and this is how it began. It's a kind of row of soldiers on a line, and this is how it quickly became a kind of physical barrier between two city halves. But what the more important than kind of looking at Berlin kind of did for me is it exposed me to the work of Matthias Ungers, Germany's most creative architect and famous architect at the time, who had been a professor in Berlin, but just when I was in Berlin, I think it was 69, he had come to Cornell. This is Matthias Ungers. Matthias Ungers, for me, was a kind of absolutely unique architect, because I think his drive was not entirely to do new things. I think his drive was to love architecture and to love buildings that exist. And I think this unique focus on what exists is for me the genius of Matthias Ungers. And I don't know anyone who could be so contagious in kind of talking about what exists, in seeing the ingenuity of what exists, and seeing the kind of beauty of what exists, also if ostensibly it is ugly or dilapidated. And what was really brilliant for me from Matthias is that kind of by simply projecting love or love of beauty on what exists, it could extract kind of somehow new things that were seemingly shaped by those existing conditions. So that was true for buildings, but also by of urban texture. But I also loved profoundly and respected profoundly by in Matthias is that he could be, if he wanted to, chaotic, and if he wanted to be extremely rational. And I don't know anyone who was so fluid in terms of kind of moving between those two extremes. And I still think that in itself represents a very important condition to handle contemporary contradictions. So I went to Cornell, and that is the reason during school, I couldn't stand more flower power anymore, and I kind of went for a year to study, or rather to work with Matthias Ungers, because it was not really studying, it was an almost orgasmic experience of discussing architecture, looking at architecture, which in the end, of course, was very broad wisdom. Going to Cornell also meant an encounter with Nixon again, 16 years after our first encounter in Jakarta. Because Nixon was embroiled in Watergate, and therefore our first experience of America was both dictated or influenced on one hand by an incredibly strong European presence, on the other hand, in its incredibly gripping American political drama. There were other influences by coincidence. In the building next door, Michel Foucault was giving a seminar on Oedipus, which I followed. There was another French art historian, Hubert Amiche, was also teaching with Foucault, who became a very lifelong friend and also a very important influence on my thinking. So what was incredibly fascinating about Cornell at the time is that you could be with one leg in America and in a really turbulent and intense America, and on the other hand be influenced by the European Ungers, but also be deeply influenced in terms of conceptualizing literature or conceptualizing studies by two eminent Frenchmen. And so that, in that sense, Delirious New York is for me a French book written by a Dutch person in English, which is, I think, a typical possibility that kind of perhaps is not so easy today. After my year in Cornell, I went to New York and was received and welcomed by Peter Eisman and Kenneth Frampton in their institute. Peter Eisman was doing architecture and becoming increasingly known for a series of very rigorous constructs. And I was interested in people in the most kind of direct sense, because I didn't want to study architecture as form. I was interested above everything else, just as Leonidov, in the encounter between events, people, and technologies, and building. And so I decided to study New York, and not New York as architecture, but kind of really the history almost the anthropology of New York and the sociology of New York. And in that direction, I was, of course, inspired completely by people like Foucault. So here, the encounter of the masses, technology in Coney Island first, but then kind of slowly but surely jumping to Manhattan. And here, in this diagram, for the first time, kind of revealed perfectly what a skyscraper is, in fact, an endless extrusion of the earth, and on every plot, a different event. There was one emblematic building that I discovered in that context, the Downtown Athletic Club. For me, still a miracle, a superposition of hundreds of sports to make the body perfect, and a very strong announcement of the wave of narcissism that would later grip New York. And where this was my most cherished discovery, a single floor plan with elevators, dressing areas, a locker room, but two adjoining facilities, a boxing, a wrestling area, and an oyster bar, and making it possible, the formula, eating oysters with boxing gloves naked on the ninth floor. And I would still say that if there's any source of our architecture and if there's any source in what we think we're doing, it is really, this is the kind of first evidence of that activity, how architecture can accommodate activity, but also provoke activity and intervene in a positive way in social life. The most a rounded, perfect example was, of course, Rockefeller Center, which I also studied. And there, in a bizarre way, things came full circle. But I discovered that Radio City Music Hall had initially been air-conditioned, not only with the normal cool air, but also with oxygen and even with laughing gas. And that therefore the system of Rockefeller Center was used to create euphoria in the visitors, and that was a kind of very strong connection to a Russian project by the architect Melnikov, who proposed surrounding Moscow specific motels in which exhausted workers would also sleep. In conditions that were again artificially kind of adjusted to induce therapeutic sleeping conditions. Now, that similarity could have been accidental, but what I discovered was that it actually was not accidental, and that the architect of Rockefeller Center had visited Moscow in the early 30s. And late in the 20s, actually talked to Melnikov and came back with this idea that air conditioning could be more than a kind of pragmatic service, but could be used to transform the atmosphere of building. And so this architect, Wallace Harrison, became then for me a kind of key actor, but also a key representative of a different kind of architecture. So what I'm trying to set up is kind of a polarity between, on the one hand, architects as intellectuals, on the other hand, architects as practitioners of a different way of looking at the profession, and I think that Wallace Harrison was one of them. What Wallace Harrison also did was kind of orchestrate the process of making Rockefeller Center. Rockefeller Center is a fiendishly complicated building, and I think that the genius of Wallace Harrison was to orchestrate that complexity in a building that could, in a remarkably short time, come to a conclusion within budget and under incredibly difficult circumstances. So I became friends with Harrison, and in that sense, that was another very important friendship. Friends with Harrison, and was told by him how the intricate steps of Rockefeller Center worked, even to the point that he explained to me how the office was organized. So that kind of organization, or rather the looking at architecture as a process of organization, of orchestration of the creative process, is one of the things I definitely took away from New York and tried to imply and apply in our own condition. So another key thing which I would like to convey particularly to the younger generation, is that if I look back on my own career, the best thing I did was to waste time. I was 24 when I started to study. I was 30 when I completed my study. When I was completed, I wasted another 6 years on kind of writing a book, and the net result was that I started even thinking about doing architecture when I was 38. And those 20 years were an absolutely grandiose investment, simply in ideas, but also making sure that I would not be kind of prematurely depleted. Speaks for itself, I think, yeah. And I see in the younger generation an absolute fear for wasting that kind of time. And that makes me kind of sometimes really sad. So in 75 we were more or less kind of ready to start, and now I'm kind of looking at the career in terms of a number of phases, because I think a career is of course the creation of an individual, but it is also submitted to certain patterns. So what we discovered, or what I discover in retrospect, we had a kind of phase of a starving artist, startup, takeoff, then unfortunately we became star architect, and then after that we needed to develop intelligence against that kind of reputation. So here, startup, we try to make projections, projects, tests of projects, and they were not kind of really entirely seriously intended. We used New York as an example, and particularly in New York, we used as a kind of test bed or laboratory Roosevelt Island, where we projected a number of kind of absolutely prototypes that tested whether we could find an equivalent architecture to the architecture of early Manhattan. And therefore, it's absolutely enormous pleasure to now be involved in Roosevelt Island again for Cornell. And very unusual experience to come back after so long. Then we went, I went back to Europe in the late 70s. And there are two things which I think are defining architecture in a much bigger way than we typically acknowledge. One is money, and the other one is politics. First, money. I believe that the entire development of architecture in the last 30 years has been defined by this movement of Wall Street, an incredible escalation, an incredible collapse, another escalation, and another collapse. But I also believe that it has been defined by politics and politicians. When I came back in Europe, we had Reagan, Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, and Mitterrand, all incredible leaders. And that was very noticeable in the architecture, because young as I was, I became involved in a kind of radical project of transformation, which was kind of related to the building of the tunnel between England and France. The project was in Lille, and the combination of the tunnel and superfast trains that psychologically shrank this part of Western Europe in an entirely new situation. So here I would say that kind of I leapt in the center of a completely political project, a project defined by politicians and by the public sector. And basically the public sector working with an architect to define a collective or shared imagination. And typically, nobody ever applies the word bureaucrat to an imagination to a bureaucrat, but in this kind of environment, that would be still a very legitimate experience. So regardless of the aesthetic, regardless of what it was, a section of the New York on a place which was defined more by technicalities, i.e., minutes away from London, minutes away from Paris, kind of rather than its context, its proper context. So it kind of disembodied and at the same time on a particular location. For a while, it was the biggest building site in Europe. And during that time in the early, so I was in a new Europe, constructing a new Europe. I maintained a relationship with America, and at the time America was Peter Eisenman, through the vehicle of the so-called Annie Conference, a wonderful organization which for 10 years kind of really combined or connected European, Japanese and American architects. But in that conference, also kind of big tensions and big conflicts became clear between Eisenman and myself, and therefore between a particular interpretation of architecture, the one of Peter Eisenman and myself. I kept insisting, as I'm doing in this lecture, that politics and the economy influence, not only influence, but define the envelope within which architecture can take place. And basically, I insisted on this thing, on this issue, not in the abstract, but by producing research, in, for instance, the development of China, research in shopping, and basically I brought these researchers to the Annie Conference, where initially they fell on deaf ears, but increasingly they created an enormous irritation and hostility. And so when basically in 1999, I also kind of really became completely exacerbated by this conflict, I decided to provoked them very strongly, and I gave a lecture from Lagos to Logos in which I presented, on the one hand, my research in the poorest and most dysfunctional city in Africa, and on the other hand, our work for the fashion brand Prada. And that really was a kind of explosive mixture after which I was no longer kind of welcome in the kind of official definition of architecture. What I think sometimes is a pity or tragic is that basically my activities as a theoretician or as a writer or even as a polemicist have somewhat shielded the actual quality of our buildings and particularly how our buildings work. Because from the library in Seattle, which immediately became almost a living room for the entire city, which offers a kind of a very pleasant and comfortable environment to do nothing, not even read, to simply exist, but which also offers excellent conditions for extreme concentration and labor. What is very evident is that from the very beginning, almost the moment the doors opened, the building was completely assumed by the population at large. And I would say that that is actually a quality of our buildings. And sorry for being so boastful, but you asked me to be sincere, sincere and innocent. And that is why I dare to say it. Also, for instance, in the theater we did in Dallas, I don't know of a single building which is actually such an efficient mixture of building and machine. As you know, it is a kind of theater where the auditorium itself is defined by the stage machinery so that it can be there or disappear. Again, a really original hybrid that functions and stimulates the creative process beyond our wildest dreams and beyond the wildest dreams from the client. The same you could say of RIT, also a very efficient machinery to capture the students that were dispersed over the entire campus and to offer them a kind of experience of intimacy and intensity, and again, almost a systematic lamination of relaxation and concentration and intensity. There again, an incredibly natural and immediate appropriation. And I'm very happy that seems to have taken place in this building too, and I'm very grateful to Milsing family, to the dean, and also to Moisen for parachuting us in this kind of situation. At this point, therefore, I remain a little bit torn between our role as an architect, which is a very intense preoccupation, but still so also my role as a so-called theoretician. And I want to end the kind of presentation by talking about a book, Project Japan, which we published a few months ago, and which is an investigation of the Japanese metabolist, and which kind of is focused on what the strength of their success was, and which identifies as their strength the fact that a number of very strong individuals kept together and in close connection during their entire life, and was not atomized as the entire architectural scene is at this moment. And also kind of worked very closely in tandem with government or with the public sector. And I think that for great architecture, the public sector is and remains a very important condition. Finally, I want to kind of very, very briefly talk about my current research. After all the kind of attention to cities, I became kind of really fascinated by the apparent opposite of cities. This is a Swiss village 20 years ago. It is called Celerina. It is completely depopulating because the countryside is increasingly not inhabited. But nevertheless, in spite of this depopulation, it is also multiplying. And so what I've become fascinated to discover what is actually happening on the countryside. And so this is the existing condition. And in spite of all the attempts, all the laws to maintain that existing condition, it is increasingly transformed in this kind of condition, in other words, in new forms. And what you see as if, inhabitants now, where there used to be an authentic countryside 100 years ago, now we have ladies from Thailand who keep the houses, run the pets, and take care of the children. And my greatest ambition at this moment is to understand what happened between this and this, and why. Thank you.
Give you a chance to ask questions. I have so many that I wanted to ask, and I have to confess that over the last 2 years that we've been working together, the project itself has been so foregrounded in everything we've discussed that I feel like I've never quite had a chance to. You can keep it low. It was fine. You were romantic. So I'm going to start with where I thought I'd end, just to make sure I get to ask this question. I have a quote from you about education, and it's one of the professions that you didn't self-describe, but I think of you first and foremost as an educator. And the quote is short, but I think it's effective. Education is, quote, anything you need to know that's not a laptop. And I was thinking, yeah, I was thinking putting that together with the appeal to take one's time and even waste it. Could be a kind of curriculum in a certain way. And I'm wondering, could you talk a little bit, given that we're in the School of Architecture, you design a building, you have many profound thoughts about what it means to be trained as an architect. Could you talk a little bit about how this instrument, how those thoughts might guide us and how we would use this building?
March. Although I could imagine that if there was a kind of global moratorium on design in all architecture schools and shift to research, but it would be very healthy. It would be actually a good thing for the world. To my words into practice, I feel we probably need a school in Moscow where we have developed a simple year curriculum. Single-year curriculum, and where we're simply teaching research and taking time to look at different subjects. But I think the most important thing is what is research, and in that study, we could conclusion that maybe research is again not entirely the right word, but what do you need to know and what do you need to look at if you want to assess issue or situation. And it's a very wonderful quality to the school because it is free and it also has a budget to travel. So we are probably, for instance, looking in what scale of Russia means. Because it's a kind of travel situation. It is so big and where the population is diminishing and where global warming will have an incredible effect. It will double the area that can be used for agriculture. And in the north, it is creating an enormous amount of new possibilities because the sea is melting, and therefore there will be a kind of northern passage. So global warming makes Russia a believing promising land, but everything else is not functioning in the same, in the right direction. And there is no population to exploit that unique improvement. So that we are kind of speculating what will that mean for Russia, but also what will it mean for the rest of Asia. Because in order to work on Russia, many populations from the south will have to migrate, or at least on a kind of temporary basis, to Russia. So that's why I'm saying it's hesitant increasingly to call it research, but this is kind of really a speculation of what may be possible in the near future. And how that can be conceptualized, and how an early identification of the process can help them to take the right steps.
So, following that, you've made a distinction many times between performance and function, and backed away from the idea of architecture of icon, and you moved very strongly. I'm wondering one of two things. Does the fact that this institution is in at Cornell, which is an amazing research powerhouse, open up anything in your mind where we could forge relationships that would advance the idea of an architecture that is essentially performative, fundamental performative? And I think of this building, and I think you said this a few times, as being a very good example of what that might be, because it's very different.
Well, I really find it very difficult to kind of suggest to you when you can use this building. But obviously, I think the exposure that it intended to have is not only an invitation of architecture to the rest, but I think that if you draw from other faculties' presences in here, I think that would be a very interesting place to begin. Because for my own time as a university, I realized that unless you really know what's going on, it's very difficult to introduce randomness or excellence. And this is the culture that promotes randomness and transparency of what is there.
Let me move to a parallel topic, which might be a meta topic as well. Preservation. It may not be obvious to many, but at first obvious to me, but now it is more simple.
that that's an achieved leitmotif that's been in your work for a very long time. And there's a beautiful video which I now have and would love to show after taking people have found their home, of you documenting the Barcelona Pavilion's anticipated future. It's a fantastic picture piece. And those of you who don't know it, it's just it's done in 1985 or 6, I think. And it is already talking about the problems, the opportunities that come with an environment which is progressively more under the domain of preservation thought. This building is remarkable in that it didn't tear down one, but instead kept it and joined two together. Much of your work seems to be now about that problem, what to do with the Republic Empire, the newfound empire of preservation. Is there something also in preservation that tends towards thinking more about performance and adapting to a given set of constraints and not about
I think that maybe I didn't talk clearly enough about the Oomers, but I think that that is not really, I would say, my sensibility was completely formed by him. Because I think I really had the privilege to spend a lot of time with him here, but also traveling here throughout the world to Poland to look at wooden architecture, but also to Berlin, it kind of really bombed and damaged. And of course, it's kind of partly romanticism that idealizes ruins, but it also was a kind of very productive lesson in identifying where whatever was slightly distressed, it was not necessarily need to be improved, but it could be accommodated. So, in that sense, it became, from the very beginning, constant, as you say, a very constant issue. But in that sense, the graph I was showing, saying or implying that the architect only has a limited amount of control of their life, and that most of the conditions are imposed for outside. Nobody would trust the other situation even if anything could remotely like preservation, because we are supposed to be so brutal and so radical in our modernity.
So Unger's had a theory of urbanism which I think he described as dialectical, but it never synthesized. It always had the tension of antithetical conditions at one and the same time. And I think a lot of your work, including your work that you proposed to the Resolute Island, polemical as it was, it's not about solving problems, it's more about reflections of one. We have about 10 more minutes, and I'm sure there are questions. And there are microphones, if I'm not mistaken, there. Does anybody want to interrupt me? Otherwise, I'll keep chatting. Yes, sir.
Curious about this the dichotomy between the solving of problems and the research. One can solve problems with research. One can also solve problems in design. So I wondered where that line was drawn for you. Something about this building. Where would you describe the end of the research aspect of work in preparation for the design and completion of this building?
I think that one of the advantages of being at this moment of my career is of course that I don't have to pretend anymore that everything is rational. And that I can insist that this is a kind of completely intuitive operation that was basically triggered by talking, walking, smelling, and listening. And therefore it's a kind of totally seamless condition, I would say. and it got really only started when we went to Forms. And of course, you can also see that as a field of research, what new different forms do we have in terms of reading, etc. I would say at this point it's not really a seamless, largely intuitive process.
I'm going to jump in if you do not, so I have a whole other topic that I want to ask you about. Your work with Prada, with fashion, and with the artwork. You said, I think in a previous lecture, that you were dismayed by the shock and awe dimension of some contemporary art practices that do not allow a kind of intellectual engagement with the work because it's so encompassing. I know you have on the boards now some projects that are brought to you by interesting kinds of clients, no longer institutions and museums, but actually by the artists themselves. And I'm wondering if you could share with us maybe the nature of some of those engagements and if they are different than or symptomatic of the shock and awe phenomenon that's absorbed the art world.
Well, I think that if we have one ability, it is to be kind of simultaneously reposed and intrigued and engaged with different conditions. So, although, yes, I'm critical of the megalomania currently involved in a lot of art, I also think that art is undergoing radical transformation of its status. And what I'm seeing, for instance, in a country like Ghana, where I'm working, is that art is becoming almost driving force or the driving narrative of the country. And that therefore there is an interesting collapse between, or merger between politics, art, education, and sport, that all are contributing to what the country is about. So that, in other words, that megalomania on the scale of individual artists is perhaps transforming in art as a kind of partial responsible for a societal blueprint. And I cannot really prove it, but we are assuming that it is the case, and therefore kind of actually, in spite of our reservations, engaging the art world fully as a new something that where the new scale and perhaps the megalomania also offer radically new possibilities. And in that sense, our work, for instance, with Marina Abramovic is an example, and it's unbelievably exciting in the sense that typically you have to kind of really work very hard to dislodge the kind of conventional elements in the program, the conventional expectations of the program. And in this case, we explicitly have the question to do something which has never been done before, and to define it rather extreme terms. To make a theater for performances of extreme duration, which therefore is a kind of hybrid between theater, hotel, institution, etc., etc. So, what we're seeing is that through this new scale of art, it can also become an incredibly radical new form of plant. And in that sense, it's really great that it's not a museum, but it's about something totally different.
Just to clarify, Ivanovic is your client, right, for that.
She is.
She is.
Why don't you just speak up? Your time has been passing.
When I look at the architecture of Frank Gehry and Zaha Hadid, their buildings seem to be very form-driven. What is the role of form in your current state of architectural practice? You seem to tend toward modernism, but you're very eccentric. I want to know your opinion of, does form drive architecture? Does architecture drive form?
I would say that it's a question. The question is where you ask the question. So if you ask the question here, I would say no. Not at all, in no way. If you ask the question in China, I would say form can be very crucial and functional there. and relevant there. If you ask Doha, I would say maybe not anymore. If you ask it in Europe, I would say never again. So it's for me a question entirely contextual.
The situation in Europe now is very austere and is cutting back and depends on provisions, that's why I'm not going to go to that. In one way, these times have forced people to think more clearly about what role the public should have here in spending on schools and our facilities. Could it not help not fix people more?
I think it's a very interesting question, and actually in Europe, I've tried in the past 3 years to also be involved at that political level. I was part of a European think tank of important politicians trying to define exactly those questions or answer those questions. One of the group, José Mario Monti, who is now president of Italy. So maybe in the near future we'll be get more opportunity in my country. But the point is that I think you can look at Europe as a disaster at this moment, but you can also look at kind of radical political transformations taking place in real time, and therefore enormous challenges, but also the unleashing of really new creative forces in politics. I'm tending a little bit to see it in those terms. I think that I see that the kind of default situation in Greece has been averted in a really smart way, but Italy is really overcoming its grotesque situation. Then I think there's a lot of new energy and a lot of new insight in Europe. I think the problem is that politicians have so long been guided by the assumed benefits of the market economy, but that they have in a way discredited their own ability to envision a future or to articulate visions. Because somehow in the market economy any vision looks a little bit passé and gauche. So in that sense, you can see that everywhere there's an inability or an inarticulateness to articulate a new relation, but I'm actually very positive.
I'm given the sign by my boss over there that we should convene in the dome for a reception. Ben will be there to continue the conversation for a little bit. And so I want to thank you all for coming. I want to remind you that tomorrow morning, breakfast in the dome, up in Sibley. Beth, at what time?
8:30 in the dome.
8:30 in the dome. Sorry that's so early, but we have a full day tomorrow. Remember, I hope you have your dancing shoes because it goes till midnight tomorrow. Please join us for reception in the dome. Ben, thank you very much.